Hello, I'm Richard Fieldhouse, and today's NESGP podcast, I'm talking to Paola Wright from up in the northeast of England. And Paola, welcome to the NESG podcast.
Thank you, nice to join you.
Today, really, I'd really like to go hear about you, and because you've been working avidly for sessional GPs over the last couple of decades, really. You're one of the key figures, one of the leading lights in the whole sessional GP movement. And so it's really just to find out what's brought you to where you are today. But also, this podcast goes out with a blog that you've written for us on working in GP hubs. And we'll talk a little bit about that too. So Paola, so first of all, when did you qualify?
So qualified in 93 for medical school, but as a GP in 2000. And as you say, sessional GPs has been a sort of passion for me since I qualified. I have been salaried low commander retainer over the years, but never done the partnership thing. And I've been a representative of sessional GPs in the Northeast for a good 15 years now. And also had other roles that support sessional GPs, in particular a role as GP tutor for the Northern Deanery, supporting the educational and appraisal needs of sessional GPs. So a few different ways and roles in which I've had an interest in sessional GPs. So thank you for your very kind introduction.
And you are actually an appraiser as well, are you, at the moment?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and the latest addition to my portfolio is very much following the fantastic model you've set up of chambers, and having set up a locum chambers up here in the northeast called Tyneside and Tynedale Pallant locum chambers.
So you've come a long way during that time. What about, actually, you said you haven't worked as a GP partner, but is that something that's crossed your mind? Is that an opportunity that's arisen? And if so, what helped you make your choice one way or the other?
I think it's not something that I've ever felt strongly drawn to do. I really enjoy the clinical aspect of general practice. I enjoy other non-clinical roles, but I wouldn't want to be responsible for premises, staff, contracts, IT, the whole lot. So very happy with having within general practice a purely clinical role and developing my non-clinical skills in other roles.
So you've sort of chosen those roles that you feel more comfortable doing, or is that just more where your skills lie?
I guess I've initially been drawn towards roles to do with appraisal and education, and also a sort of leadership role, setting up and running our sessional GP group in the Northeast. And then more recently, I've taken on a role relating to quality at the CCG. It's great that we can, as GPs, do so many varied roles. There's lots of interesting and stimulating professional experiences to be had from these portfolios.
So it's emphasis on quality and an emphasis on education, and in particular in its relation to sessional GPs. And you've been very successful, haven't you, with a huge number of sessional GPs in the Northeast Locum Group, and you've also done a lot on self-directed learning groups as well. So lots about, I guess, getting networks of GPs together. A lot about, and you must have really helped reduce the isolation for a lot of sessional GPs by doing all of this.
Well, it's nice of you to say that, Richard. I have to say it has been a real passion of mine to tackle isolation and help set up networks. I mean, the Northeast Locum Group, when I got involved, had 60 members, and I rotated through various different roles in that until I became chair. It had around 200 members, and by the time I stepped down, it had 450. And I do think that group has made a huge difference in terms of sessional GPs, knowing that they have a community that they can be supported by, a community that can give them a voice and also improve their access to professional and educational opportunities. And the setting up the learning groups has been a great journey as well. And every time I praise GPs who've joined a learning group on the back of my initiatives, I it's just very gratifying to see how much my colleagues get out of being in learning groups. So And I've written a little bit about that in the BMJ and in Education for Primary Care and so on. So that there's a few resources out there for people who are interested in those groups.
And now you're moving into working as part of a locum chambers. So that's interesting too. Where does that fit in, having with that basis of and that huge experience you've got of sessional GP groups and large numbers of sessional GPs? So where's the chambers going to fit into this?
So what I've observed over recent years is that because of the increasing burden that practices have in terms of doing pre-employment checks, I'm seeing a shift in practices wanting to hire locums via intermediaries. So that could be agencies, it could be online Uber type platforms, or it could be chambers. And I've done a lot of reading over the last couple of years, and a particular lot of reading around the legal cases of some of these platforms, and really get the sense that if locums are going to have to work through platforms, they need to work through platforms that have a professional ethos and provide peer support, education, and are not simply selling locum time as a commodity. So we know that, you know, the chambers model that you set up, which is a fantastic model, has a whole range of clinical governance characteristics, which mean that it's a quality assured service and that it supports the locums. And also helps retain them in the workforce, unlike the much more sort of commercialised platforms, which, you know, if a locum is doing work through those and gets into trouble, that they'll completely could be hung out to dry without any protection whatsoever. So I do feel quite strongly that, you know, that the percentage of GPs who are working freelance is going up, the number of workers in the population in general that's working freelance is going up, and there's a real risk of exploitation of these workers unless they are working through platforms that look after them. So and as you know, I've said before that the sort of the publication of Good Work, the Taylor Review, brings out lots of these interesting issues around platform working and bogus self. So I think it's a really important time to look at chambers again.
Because the Taylor Review came out last year, didn't it? And that had 7 recommendations about improving working practice. One of those being this thing, this dependent contractor, which is because, as I understand it, there are currently employee. You can be an employee or you can be self-employed, but there's this vague intermediary called a worker, and that is that where people like Deliveroo and Uber have come under fire because they've got people in the workforce who are somehow bound by the terms and conditions of those platforms, but also when it suits the platforms, it seems like, but when it doesn't suit the platform, it's sort of left to the worker themselves to then flounder or not be supported or whatever. Is that a fair appraisal of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot in the Taylor Review that's actually technically quite challenging for those of us who aren't sort of in a human resources environment. But I think the way that the aspect in which it's relevant to sessional GPs is that what we're seeing is increasing number of freelancers who are caught in this worst of both worlds. So they don't, although they're freelance, they no longer have the autonomy of being able to define their terms and conditions and their fees. Those are being defined for them by the platform, and yet they don't have any of the protections of employment rights. And this is this term, bogus self-employment, that is used in the Taylor Review. And I think increasingly there is a risk of that happening with GP locums. So I think raising awareness about that when you get large platforms or locum banks imposing terms and conditions and becoming a dominant supplier in an area, and the locums find that if they don't agree to those terms regarding which they've not been consulted, that they can't work anywhere locally. So there's a lot to think about in these changes. And the other thing I feel fairly passionately about is that it's important for freelance workers to have a voice. And we have had some experiences of locums feeling that they can't get union representation because they're not in an employment relationship, and so they're actually more vulnerable. And the Taylor Review talks about the importance of worker voice, even when they're freelance. So, and one of the concessions in one of the Uber legal cases was precisely that they were going to introduce some form of consultative participation of their freelance workers. So these are really interesting times for freelancers.
And this is, of course, where chambers can help, because they allow those locums to have a potential for a consultative voice within their chambers and have some sort of say with how things work.
That's right, yes. And you know, that professional voice is so important when you look at all these issues to do with risks and safety. You need somebody who is able to voice the risk issues that locums face when they go to an organisation where they've not had an induction, they may not be provided with appropriate logins or access to local guidelines, that they're suddenly asked to supervise individuals they didn't know they were supervising, and so on. So there's a lot that chambers can do in terms of defining terms of working, minimum standards of support and induction, that it can be really important for patient safety.
So this professional self-determination, then, where we as professional doctors, who each of us knows our own limitations, is what you're saying, that if you're working for these big online platforms and having to sign up to their terms and conditions, you're not so much able to self-determine, whereas if you're part of a chambers, you can have much more of a say, and you've got the size, the reactivity, and I guess because within a chambers as a locum, you're paying for the service, whereas on these online platforms, the practices are paying for the service. Are those what sort of determining those differences?
Yeah, I mean, that's a key point, actually. And that's what, when I give talks to newly qualified GPs about choosing what intermediary they're prepared to work in, you know, there isn't a right answer, but it's important to understand the way these organisations work. So you're right, an intermediary that charges, makes its profit directly from charging practices, has as its primary customer the practice. Whereas an intermediary that charges the locums is primarily concerned with supporting the locums. And so, you know, it's important to bear that in mind. If you run into difficulties as a locum working for an intermediary that charges the practice, it's going to be much harder to convey your point of view regarding systemic failings in a significant event than it would be if you're working within an organisation that is listening to the professional point of view. So I do feel quite strongly that, and as we know, we're going to go and talk about hubs, as new models of care are developed where they're sort of untested, that those initial months and years of learning from the experience to make it safer has got to take on board the actual clinical experiences of those clinicians working in them. And if they're freelancers without any voice, you know, whose outlook and opinions are not taken on board, it's a missed opportunity for refining those systems and indeed for making them safe.
So what is it we can do then to make locum chambers much more appealing in terms of there seems to be almost a glass ceiling in terms of the numbers that the various organisations, like the Pallant that I helped set up but I'm no longer part of since last year, and the likes of the Yorkshire Medical Chambers and Stirling and all these, and Greenfields and all these other locums around the country have set up these fantastic chambers, but they seem, the numbers stop growing beyond a certain point. What's stopping people joining them, and what more can be done to get more locums working as part of a chambers?
I'm not sure I have the answer to that. I mean, I think what we've seen is a good 10 years when there wasn't really any other efficient, organised alternative to chambers. So you either did freelance work or you worked through a chambers. Okay, there were a few agencies, but the fact that sometimes agency work wasn't superannuated would remove that from the equation. But what's changed all that is this huge growth in the gig economy of these web-based platforms, and I don't think we've seen the dust settle. And of course, GPs are likely to be influenced into joining a platform where they can use it for free. So I think, sadly, many GPs are a little bit short-sighted and think that, you know, if you can join an intermediary where there's no direct charge to you, why would you join one where you are charged? So I don't know what's going to happen. I think, certainly I plan to raise awareness about the importance of working through the right platform.
I think you're doing it very well.
Thank you, Richard. And
you mentioned hubs as well as another model that GPs are finding themselves in. Although this is sort of slightly different. So in this article on hub life and working in hubs, so tell us first of all what a GP hub is.
So there's a bit of a different sort of terminology here. That there's been this imperative to provide the 7-day access that Jeremy Hunt wants, and so hubs have been one way to solve that problem, because of course many practices can barely provide their 5-day service. They're already struggling. So it's been a model where practices pool together resources to provide bookable appointments on one or two sites that are available to all the practices in the locality. So it's sort of routine G appointments for patients who are registered to a group of practices. As this model's evolved, the means by which you can get booked into these hubs has changed. So initially you could only be booked in via your own practice, but over time, now you might be booked in after calling 111, or you might even be booked in having consulted your out-of-hours provider. They might book you into one of these slots. You might be booked in after presenting to a walk-in centre and so on. So there's various routes for the patient who ends up being seen in a hub. But from the point of view of the doctor working there, they're quite a pleasant experience. I mean, you have 15-minute appointments generally. It's largely the sort of the diagnostic end of general practice rather than managing complicated comorbid chronic disease and chronic mental health. And you don't have the sort of taxing side of sifting through hundreds of lab results and letters and so on, which are interesting work, but they're also very, very demanding and often something that's squeezed on top of a full day in one's own practice. So it makes for quite a pleasant change of clinical activity and offers a great flexibility insofar as you can dip in and out of the hub work when you've got sort of slightly quieter weeks as regards your other portfolios. So it's a nice way to supplement your clinical income without if you're faced with the decision, shall I increase my working sessions from 4 till 6 or 2 till 4 a week, you have to then negotiate extra hard to get all those holidays you need for in school holidays and so on. Whereas if you're just dipping in and out of hub work, you can obviously choose to do that only in term time. So that's very appealing for a whole raft of GPs like us who still have school aged children.
So it's it seems like it's a great way for patients to or for practices to who don't have that capacity to sort of centralise a way for all local patients to actually get some access, potentially 7 days a week, and also some great opportunities for working there as sessional GPs. But in this article, or any type of GP, but in this article you uncover some it's not as good as it seems type of thing. So what have you picked up on there?
So quite interesting. So clearly practices, there are many practices that feel quite resentful that this funding is going into a new type of service rather than into basic core core GMS funding, and I can understand that. My response to that would probably be that it goes a little bit further to have some of that funding shared across a locality if the service is well managed. But and the patients certainly seem extremely grateful that they're being offered an appointment at short notice.
Yeah.
You get the sort of, along with that resentment, that there's a degree of contempt or disdain from practice-based GPs, thinking that you've got a cushy number and you're doing an easy job. It is quite nice to see these patients with relatively self-limiting conditions and to have full access to the medical records. But unfortunately, occasionally you do get patients who pitch up in the hub service who are not appropriate, you know, shouldn't be there at all, who need a two-week wait referral or wanting to sort of follow up for a pre-existing complicated problem. And so that can be difficult to deal with and explain to them that they've ended up in the wrong service. So there are, you know, there are downs and patients sort of trying to understand, you know, you can get this quite Kafkaesque situation where the patient hasn't been able to get an appointment with their own doctor at their practice. So they're, because their practice doesn't have capacity, so they're booked into the hub and they end up seeing one of their own doctors at the hub and, you know, in another building, and they're completely perplexed by all this. So it's quite hard to explain.
But Kafkaesque is something we're getting quite good at now in the NHS, though, isn't it? It seems like what you're describing, there's already a sort of a mismatch of communication, of expectations between different camps. And one thing you talk about in the article is about how this scepticism and resentment actually seems to tarnish the opinions of the sort of practice opinions of the GPs working in these because of this mismatch. And I'm almost wondering if there is a way that in time those GPs working in hubs are going to start getting poorer feedback. They're going to be sort of treated just again like the second cousins again, as locums have for many years. It doesn't seem a particularly great step forward from what you're saying in this.
I think there's a risk of that, and I think there's a risk of that, you know, the practice-based doctors looking at consultations entered at the hub and saying, oh, well, you know, that's been a waste of time because they're just going to come back here and see another doctor. And there are the complexities around initiating investigations in the hub, which are going to have to go back to the practice because there's no mechanism for follow-up of investigations at the hub. You know, there's always going to be some scepticism and a degree of judging around new roles when people are perceived to be doing something a bit different. But I feel on the whole, I think hubs have been a positive development. I think they provide a much needed sort of cushion for primary care. There have been some quite difficult aspects of hub work, and particularly the confusion over indemnity, which have placed some hub docs in a very difficult position indeed.
So what's happened there then?
So what we've seen is that initially there were some doctors looking into hub work who were told, oh, you can't do hub work unless your indemnity covers you for out of hours work, which is obviously generally more expensive. And then what we had was the MDOs moving towards a system of classifying their indemnity cover, which was slightly different. So it used to be sort of in hours and out of hours being the two levels. And then they moved towards this concept of scheduled and unscheduled. So hub work fell under the lower cost scheduled care, providing appointments are booked, you have access to the full medical record, and the patients are registered to the local practices. But we had an instance of a doctor who was seeing patients in their hub, and the hub was housed in the same building as a walk-in centre, and the walk-in centre was very busy, the hub was quiet. So they moved some patients across from the walk-in centre to the hub and booked them into the hub slots. And the doctor obviously, you know, is booked to work. The hub will see any patients that are booked into it and ends up asking, you know, their indemnity, you know, just to check, you know, am I covered for this? With the MDO saying, oh, no, you're not covered to see walk-in patients. You're only to see hub patients, which obviously placed the doctor in a very difficult position. And when this was then subsequently clarified in emails, the medical indemnity organisation confirmed that indeed any patients seen in the hub, providing they'd been booked, the doctor had access to the full record and they were registered with a local practice, would be considered scheduled care. So lots of muddled messages, and so we've had doctors pull out of hub work because of this confusion, and then also complicated by the fact that I think one of the MDOs considers hub work to be unscheduled if it's occurring at the weekend, whereas the other two considered hub work to be scheduled. The complexities around indemnity have been quite a challenge.
So Kafkaesque all over again, then, as you say.
Indeed.
Okay, then. So So you're carrying on working in a hub, and how do you think the hub working model is going to evolve over the next few years? Are things starting to settle down? Because even since you wrote that article, it sounds like things are being teased out and more experience is being gained, and people are perhaps maybe starting to appreciate these hubs more.
Well, certainly what we've seen. So in our Northeast Sessional GP group, we have a mechanism for cascading vacancies, across our 450 members, and the number of vacancies for hub work is going up. They're coming, they're coming through in big numbers, and sessional GPs, particularly newly qualifieds, are quite liking signing up to work in them. One of the complications is when the hub work is advertised for a headline hourly rate, which doesn't include superannuation, and then people are told that it's not superannuable. And so that has caused some difficulties with, you know, it's all very well if you're in your mid to late 50s and you've hit your lifetime pension allowance and you're not looking to superannuate, but many sessional GPs are women, you know, in mid-career working part-time who very much need to make sure that all their income is superannuable. So that's created some difficulties as well. Things are changing all the time. And I guess the other role that is thrown in the mix is this emergency department GP role, which also has been taking off over the past year. I don't have direct experience of that, but it's often part of the same urgent care service as hubs. So, lots of change and lots of new roles for sessionals to try out.
And do you think in time locum chambers will be able to have more input into safety and quality in these hubs and help? Because there seems to be, as you're saying, confusion over rates and pensions and all of that. And it sounds to me, therefore, that maybe it's the hubs are determining the pay and those sorts of conditions rather than left to a sort of more like a free market that a locum would be used to. Are the hubs quite variable in that respect, or do they generally tend to be calling the shots, as it were?
So the hubs do tend to set the rates. So there's quite a big variation in the rates that hubs pay, interestingly. I'm not entirely sure why. Certainly that there have been areas where chambers have engaged directly with providing manpower for hubs. I don't have direct experience of that, but I think that's been seen quite positively by areas where chambers are more dynamic and more well established. So, hard to know what lies ahead, but probably more change is the answer. But coming back to your point about safety and new systems, I know everybody has been very focused on the Dr. Bawagaba case, and I think there are a lot of learning points for sessional GPs in that case, in terms of knowing how to flag up, you know, high risk situations, insisting on induction, insisting that you're working within a workload that is manageable for you, for your level of experience and skills, and so on. So I think perhaps on another day we could have a chat about that, because I think that's something that really could do with exploring for our sessional colleagues.
The sort of the ability to self-determine with your own professional constraints rather than being imposed upon you.
The ability to stay safe in the different environments in which you go and work in. So I think lots of parallels between the Bawagaba situation and sessional GPs that are worth teasing out.
I mean, in that respect, and sort of reflecting against the many lessons of mid-staffs, working in a hub, bearing in mind that, I guess as a locum, you're not so much in a position of self-determination, you are being determined by how the hub wants you to work. What's your experience about if you were to come across any system problems, system errors, issues? I think even in your article, you've mentioned the fact that sometimes you don't have the notes. are there ways to report these things and for your voice to be heard in these organisations?
So at the end of the day, all these organisations have to sort of pass CQC standards, and so they have to have a critical event reporting mechanism that leads to effective actions. And but I think you can feel quite disempowered as a temporary worker in terms of highlighting the difficulties you're experiencing, and it takes a degree of confidence to step up and speak out and say, actually, I think this isn't safe, you know. So I think it's always a good sign if you raise a concern in an organisation like this. It's always interesting and important to see what are their timescales for acknowledging the significant event, and what are their timescales for resolving it, because that gives you a real measure as to how robust their clinical governance systems are
and the seriousness with which they're taking this as well. That, yes, you're right. I think you were right. That would make a really good future conversation. Because that is a whole podcast or series of podcasts in itself. Okay, so in terms of going forwards and over the, I mean, there's been big changes you and I have seen over the last 10, 15 years, all sorts of things that we didn't expect and didn't predict. What do you think's going to happen over the next few years, 5 years, maybe even 10 years? Have you got anything in mind that issues we might start to face?
Well, gosh. There's such a lot of change, isn't there? I mean, clearly we're moving to a lot of organisations working at scale, and the challenge is going to be to maintain that very personal environment that we've had in general practice, that's been very flexible to accommodate people's personal work-life balance needs, for some people more so than hospital posts traditionally. Whether moving to organisations at scale will be able to do that. You know, people talk about organisations at scale having stronger, sort of more robust human resources systems, and the model contract, BMA model contract, being more closely observed, better job planning. And in theory, if you're part of a larger pool of salaried doctors, perhaps there will be more flexibility in terms of taking holiday and school holidays and so on. But you just don't know. So it's going to be an interesting few years, I think, to see how it all shapes up. But certainly the options of topping up some regular practice work with some sessional work seems to provide a really good flexible option for me personally and for many like me, you know, to have that permanence of a team on the one hand for part of the week, and the ability to top up with additional clinical work in a way that doesn't put a strain on your personal caring responsibilities.
Well, that all sounds like a good vision for the, certainly over the next 5 years, and certainly for sessional GPs as well. But obviously, where all of that or any of that fits in the context of the NHS, I'm only asking that question because I don't have a clue myself. you know, it's a fool's game to predict. So, Paul, that was really interesting. Thank you so much for taking part in this. And I think we should take you up on your offer of going much more into the sort of all those safety aspects in a future podcast. So thank you very much. Take care, and we'll speak to you again in the future. And please, listeners, do look out for Paola's article that on the NESGP website that goes along with this podcast. Paola, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. It's great to talk to you.
You too. Goodbye.